This is the Education Gadfly Show.
The nation's first ever whole enchilada. What do we call this? The big enchilada. I mean, this has been the holy grail.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Matt Beyenberg. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Matt is the Director of Education Policy at the Goldwater Institute, of course, in Arizona. He also serves as Director of the Institute's Van Sittert Center for Constitutional Advocacy. Before joining Goldwater, Matt was a Senior Analyst at the Arizona Joint Legislative Budget Committee, meaning he was a state legislative staffer, right? I got that right?
Yeah, numbers guy working down at the legislature on K-12 and university funding.
That's great. This is you are an education policy wonk through and through, Matt. You are among friends here.
Guilty as charged, yes.
Yeah, well, good. And look, and Matt is also somebody who can feel very good because he was a driving force behind the nation's first ever universal whole enchilada. What do we call this? Education savings account. We're going to talk about all that here on Ed Reform Update. Okay, Matt, so everyone's talking about this, as well they should, Arizona, with a landmark piece of legislation just signed by your governor, Doug Ducey, that is going to allow basically any school-aged child in the state to have an education savings account of significant value. This is, as I said, the big enchilada. I mean, this has been the holy grail for the school choice movement for many years. And you guys got it across the finish line. So first of all, congratulations. And second of all, tell us about it. What is this thing? How is it going to work?
Yeah. So as you said, this is expansion, the Empowerment Scholarship Account or ESA or Education Savings Account, as they're kind of known more broadly. And, you know, Arizona was the first state to create one of these. Goldwater helped pioneer that back in 2011 and essentially, you know, saying, if you don't want to send your student to a public school, you could take a portion of that funding and put it into any kind of private at-home type of education. And we had this program for the last 10 years. It's grown from just about 100 students in year one to almost 12,000 this past year. As of now, or prior to this legislation, only about a quarter of Arizona students were actually eligible for the program. So kids coming from special needs communities, failing schools that had an official DRF rating, Native American reservations, families who had parents in the military. So certain groups of kids were eligible for this. The majority of Arizona students were not. And so over the last several years, we've been working both in terms of just doing reforms and improvements to the program and also trying to extend eligibility for it to make sure that more kids have access to it. So this piece of legislation, as you mentioned, that Governor Ducey just signed, sponsored by Representative Ben Thoma in the Arizona House. And exactly as you said, it provides an ESA, or at least eligibility for an ESA to every student who is eligible for a public school in Arizona, now is eligible for an ESA. So essentially, it is treating all kids the same, giving the same access and an eligibility to all kids, regardless of background, zip code, wherever they're coming from. Now, every student has a choice to opt into a district school, a charter school, or the ESA program if they want to do that and get some support and relief to pursue that option.
Okay, so let's explain how this works then. Let's imagine you decide I'm going to use a traditional public school or a charter school. You now write a check to that school? How does that work?
Good question. So typically, you know, a student who's going to a school district or a charter school, they automatically get funding from the state. There's a funding formula that says every kid who walks through your door, you're going to get a certain amount of money. In Arizona, it comes out to all sources of state and local funding. Our public schools average about $11,000 per kid per year, plus all the federal funds. With the ESA, it comes out to about $7,000 that is instead given to the family. So that money gets put into an account, kind of like a health savings account or sort of a savings account. And the family basically has access to that. And they have essentially freedom to use those funds for any kind of educational purpose. Again, whether that's tuition or tutoring, textbooks, any of these kind of learning materials or services that they think would work for their students. So that money gets put into an account. It is the family's account to use and direct as they want. So if they want to do private school, they can. If they want to do at-home education, they can. It does not go through the school district. It is the student has opted out of that district or out of that charter school. And instead of taxpayers basically footing the bill to have that kid get educated in the public school system, they're paying a portion of that and putting it into the account for the family.
All right. So if you are in a public school or a public charter school, nothing changes. You don't get one of these accounts. Your funding remains the same.
That's okay, right. You're eligible for it if you'd like to opt into it, but that's right.
Gotcha. Okay. But if you decide that you want to do homeschool or you want to go to private school, then you get one of these accounts. So, I mean, I imagine when this kind of thing has been debated in other places, one of the big debates is always, oh my goodness, all of a sudden, all these families paying private school tuition are now going to get a big public subsidy, which I guess is the case, right? Every private school kid is now going to have to pay $7,000 less in tuition than they did before.
So there's a couple things here. And again, the ESA program, yes, regardless of whether you're coming from a public school or private or homeschooling right now, it's not going to say, you know, certain families have this right and others don't. Basically says every family gets it. And you know, the parallel is every family in Arizona is eligible to enroll in a public school, right? We hear this thing about, well, these are for families who don't need the help. There's no means testing. There's no income cap on public school, regardless of what your family's background is. You right now have a taxpayer-funded mandate. If you want to send your kid to a public school, taxpayers will pay for that, right? So to argue somehow that certain families are deserving of this and others aren't, I think misses the mark. And the other thing, in Arizona, you know, across the nation, we saw during COVID, right, families drop out of the public school system. So we had 50,000 families, 50,000 students drop out of district schools during COVID. We still have about 18,000 of those who have not come back into the system. So they're in private education, at-home education, whatever it might be. So these are families who were public school students who now are not. And so to argue and say, well, they're not public school kids, we shouldn't foot the bill for them and make them eligible, you know, for an ESA, I think is indicative of kind of what's wrong with that thinking that says, well, if you're not in a public school now, you obviously don't need any assistance and help. Yeah, there are a lot of families who are shouldering that burden and making that sacrifice to get their students into public or homeschool, and to say, well, we should just cut them loose. They're not deserving of assistance, even though they would be if they went to a public school at an even higher cost to taxpayers, I think is kind of thinking about it the wrong way.
Yeah. And to be clear, Matt, I'm not arguing that point either. I'm just curious because, you know, but it is a budget issue, right? Because at least at first, that's a big new expense for the state that it didn't have before. You know, sometimes, you know, if you talk about, say, kids moving from a traditional public school to a charter school, you know, in some cases that's an even, it doesn't really cost the state anything. And in some cases, some of these voucher programs actually saves the state some money, depending on how they play out. But this, it sounds like in the short term, this is going to cost some new money because you've got some families out there who were paying for this tuition on their own, and now they're going to have some help. Again, no argument there, just the fact.
That's right. And Arizona came into this budget session with a surplus well over $1 billion. And so what we saw is the state legislature put in $600 million of ongoing permanent funding for K-12 schools, in addition to several hundred million dollars of extra funding. And they also are, again, providing the opportunities for these families. So, you know, the budget analysts, you know, as they said, Arizona, we have other private school tax credit programs that the official state estimates, you know, suggest that, you know, up to half of kids are going to stick on that program instead, right? So this isn't now that every student is going to switch on this program. Certainly many will. But yeah, the state basically looks at this and says, yes, this is a worthy investment to fund students regardless of where they're coming from and where they're going. But yes, it obviously does have a cost just as funding the public schools does.
I don't know. I have to suspect that one reason Arizona has so much extra money right now is because of the federal American Rescue Plan from last year. So thank you, President Biden, for supporting this universal private school choice program. You can comment on that if you want.
You know, I will say a shout out to our state. You know, we have had extraordinary growth. And so the budget surplus, that's looking just at ongoing permanent, you know, general fund revenues. So that's, you know, seeing growth in the state economy, seeing the increases in receipts that we're bringing in through our state coffers. And so, obviously, you know, we've done a lot of work and going to be putting more out on kind of the barrage of funding that the schools got for COVID funds. And that's another thing, right? We hear this is going to steal money from public schools. Arizona public schools just got $4 billion in COVID funds that the schools, you know, are awash in still. And so these funding arguments, I think, really don't hold water when you get down to it.
So, all right. So now let me push you on my main argument, my main concern. You know, again, as somebody who supports all forms of school choice, but does have some preferences, right? I tend to think I like the charter school model because it combines school choice with real accountability for results. I'm somebody who cares whether or not NAEP scores go up, whether or not student achievement goes up. I think that matters, especially in the early grades, right? If we want kids to have good options once they get to high school about doing college prep or real career tech or apprenticeships, they've got to have those basic skills in reading and writing and math, and they've got to have content knowledge that helps them do reading comprehension. That's not going to happen automatically. I mean, kids come in way behind even in kindergarten. So we need excellent elementary schools, middle schools that know how to boost student achievement to help kids get ready. Something like this, I mean, you're relying, of course, on the accountability of parental choice, of competition. But, you know, I feel like we know enough about how some of these programs have played out around the country to know that there's going to be some schools and some providers and some parents that don't prioritize student achievement. And so you're not going to see student achievement. I mean, what do you say to that?
Yeah. And again, a good question on that. And, you know, as you said, right, the public school system, there's certain measures in place, right? You have testing requirements and A through F letter grades. And so the question is, well, is the ESA program, is that going to have a high degree, a high caliber of educational outcomes, right? If we don't put these same kind of regulations or restrictions on it. 2/3 of Arizona kids in public schools are not proficient in math and reading, right? And a lot of that is, you know, kind of what they're coming into the system with, and a lot of it is the failure of the schools, right? So even if we have a system that says, look, we're going to assign letter grades to our schools, and we're going to know which are high performing, which are not, very few of them are actually rated D or F schools. Less than 10% get that rating. You have a huge swath that are rated as C, right? Just good enough. These are mediocre. Don't worry about it. There's no concern here. And yet you look at the percentage of kids that are proficient there, and it is abysmal, right? And so I think that there's an argument that says, yes, you can stack on testing. Yes, you can stack on some of these accountability measures. And that's a whole great conversation worth having about, you know, how should we structure this for our public school system? But those are clearly not leading to outcomes that say, just because we are testing these kids and measuring it and giving it our stamp of, you know, this is a C-rated school, that this is, you know, setting these kids on a path for success. And, you know, I'm sure you're obviously familiar with, you know, the literature that's out there, right, around the private school choice programs that are out there, the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship. You know, Patrick Wolf and others have done a lot of extensive studies on this. Urban Institute, folks at, you know, the UC system in California have looked at these and said, yeah, look, these private choice programs actually lead to better outcomes. And even the test scores themselves, right, those tend to be modestly better. But what you see are longer term better outcomes around graduation rates, college going rates, actual performance in college, some of these other factors around, you know, long term life outcomes, civic engagement, right? These are things that aren't even necessarily quantifiable on a math and reading test. So absolutely, that should be the baseline of what our schools are intended to equip the kids with. But I think that we have seen from these other programs, it is boosting kids on a variety of measures, not simply a test score. And that's something that, yes, ultimately at the end of the day, it does come down to making sure parents have those choices. And you're certainly going to have poor performers, as you do in any field, right? To argue that there's going to be great or poor public schools, great or poor private schools, great or poor, you know, public charter schools, that's always going to be true. And the question is, on balance, is this a policy that is improving, you know, the opportunities for students and families or not? And you know, I think given the literature and given the increased choice for parents, the answer is yes.
Well, we'll be able to tell, I guess, on the NAEP, we'll be able to look at both, the public school students, how they do, at private as well. Although, gosh, do we actually get that by state? I guess I need to check into that. Is there any other kind of evaluation that's going to go along with this to know how these kids that now are opted out of the public system altogether, how they are doing in terms of student learning? Anything, any accountability on results?
So we've seen, and our State Board of Education, kind of the Department of Education, the State Board of Education kind of share responsibilities in administering this program. And we've seen parents come and testify to those, you know, basically to the State Board members talking about their experiences with this, right? So again, I think that there's a lot of...
That's a no, Matt. You can just say no. That's fine. That's fine. That we won't know. We won't know. We won't have test scores for these kids that opt.
Well, and look, I think one thing you can look at, right? Again, some of the literature that's out there, the folks who've looked at things like the Florida Tax Credit Program, and Arizona's been an example of this, right? Even as we've expanded our charter sector, which we also heard from the unions and those groups, this is going to decimate our public schools. These are not certified teachers. This is the Wild West. This is terrible. Arizona has actually seen increases in our NAEP scores faster than other states, right? Stanford Opportunity Project's shown the same thing, right?
Yep,
so I think that, you know, these arguments that say we're going to defund our public schools and we're going to throw education into a tailspin, you're still going to have those same measures of our public school system. And you're going to have parents who are voting with their feet to go to private schools if they want to do that.
Well, look, you know, back on the research, the area where I think the research is most clear is that whether you're talking about private school choice or charter schools, is the competitive effects research that has been most consistent, right? Is that competition works, that in places that introduce competition, we see the traditional public schools do better, certainly no worse, but in most studies, they do better. So, you know, look, I'm not actually so worried about the kids that remain in traditional public schools. I do think that this is going to put yet more pressure on Arizona public schools to improve and to recruit families. It's already under a lot of pressure because of the large charter sector and these other programs that you've had. But look, I like it. I mean, and I'm okay with the universality in that, you know, I think we've struggled over the years to figure out anything that can shake up, especially the affluent suburban district schools where there's a lot of complacency. And I think this has a potential of really doing that, right? And so it's going to be a fun one to watch. Well, again, Matt, congratulations. I know this was something you've been working on for many years, and along with lots of other people there in Arizona and around the country. And it's going to be fascinating to watch. So maybe we'll have you back on sometime to check in and see how it's going.
Happy to do so. Again, thanks for having me and really appreciate it.
All right. Again, Matt Beinberg, the Director of Education Policy at Arizona's Goldwater Institute. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
I understand you had a big trip down to Florida. Hope you guys had a good time.
I did. I finally got a little suntan on these white legs of mine. So it was good. It was great. You know, it was, you know, I think I told you I've got a running annual trip with my college friends every July. We've managed to stick with it for over 10 years now. So pretty cool.
That is excellent. I love it.
Yes.
I love it. You know, all the research is that women are better than men at maintaining these kinds of friendships.
And I think that's probably true. We just talk about you guys while we're there, though.
Oh, well, of course. Good.
Good stuff. Good
we're
stuff.
There in of course. Spirit. You're very good.
That's right.
All right. Well, what you got for us on the research front?
We have a new randomized study out of Harvard, examines the impact of content literacy. I don't know if you saw this one or not, Mike, but it reminded me of, you know, Edie Hirsch, Core Knowledge, all that good stuff. It's a content literacy intervention called the Model of Reading Engagement, or MORE, M-O-R-E, on elementary school kids' reading comprehension. And so again, you know, I'm familiar with Core Knowledge, but this one has some of the same principles as the Core Knowledge content-rich approach. So it's a spiraled series of lessons. They don't call it a curriculum because it doesn't cover a whole year's worth of learning. But students learn about a topic across grades, and they build upon a schema to apply their new knowledge. And the schema is like, you know, generalizable features across different topics. So for instance, in grade one, the kids might learn about how animals survive in their habitat, and they might learn with an example of a polar bear. And then in grade two, to build on this schema of animal survival, they might learn how paleontologists use fossil evidence to develop theories about dinosaurs. And then in grade three, they might learn about subsystems in the human body, like our muscular and nervous systems, and how those function to keep us alive. So in other words, again, they're just building the schema, applying it to different species and, you know, and so on to build this domain and content knowledge. They also have these interactive read alouds of these thematically related informational text that they read to the kids. And then they have concept maps where they show the kids how these different ideas are related visually.
This all sounds great to me.
Yep. Small scale study takes place in one large district in North Carolina. 15 schools were randomly assigned to treatment and 15 to control. Over 3 years, the treatment group kids participated in the spring grade one lessons in science and social studies. Then in grade two and fall and spring, they had more science lessons. And then grade three, pandemic. So they had remote lessons in signing in science, but they also had these reading aloud of these thematically informational texts in the summer months, even following grade one and two. And then again in grade three, pandemic happened. So all the kids got 10 hours, both the treatment and the control kids got 10 hours of these more lessons remotely. So really what they're examining is the long-term effects. So across these 3 years on third graders' outcomes, comparing this treatment group that had the grade one, grade two, and grade three interventions. And then the control group had the business as usual for grade one and two, but they got this 10 hours of instruction in grade three. All right, that everybody got.
Okay.
All right. Teacher survey data from both groups reveal that both the treatment and the control teachers spend about the same amount of time teaching ELA, reading, and math. But the treatment teachers spent more time on science and social studies over the course of 3 years. And then researchers developed a domain-specific science vocabulary test to be administered after grade three. I was kind of intrigued in what these measures were. So the kids had to say which of the taught words went together with the untaught words. So in other words, you might have learned the word fracture, But then you had to know that the word skeletal had something to do with fracture because they didn't teach that skeletal word. They also developed a science-specific reading comprehension test that required them to transfer knowledge whereby some of the passages were related but didn't include the taught words. So they'd have to figure out this is related content, even though we don't know these words. It's in the, quote, schema of content. And then they had this integrated state test data, standardized data as well. All right. Finally, results. Students randomly assigned to the treatment condition outperformed the control students in reading comprehension.
Yes.
And mathematics.
Ooh.
On third grade standardized test. They also outperformed on this domain-specific science vocabulary test I just told you about.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they dug into the subgroups, they had especially positive impact for students who were in low to moderate SES neighborhoods on the reading comprehension and the mathematics portions of the measures. And the they have some little section where they're describing like what's going on with this cross-domain transfer in math. We've actually seen this in other studies as well, and they're just hypothesizing that maybe there are these similar cognitive processes that you use in both math and ELA, like maybe you have some nonverbal reasoning skills that you use in both. They really don't know. But bottom line, very promising study when it comes to this content-rich curricula and building background knowledge. But again, just one district, teacher self-report. Some people don't like that. You know, they'd rather have direct measures of classroom instruction, which we don't have here.
Mm-hmm.
But still, promising study. And I think it's beginning to build on this empirical evidence relating to content knowledge that we've been needing to build for a while.
Yeah, no, this is great. Look, boy, E.D. Hirsch, who I believe is getting close to being 100 years old. I think he's in the ballpark. Maybe I've got that. Maybe I'm exaggerating. But he is finally being validated, you know, and his all his work that a lot of fans out there, of course. But
That's
there's always been this missing piece, which has been it's really been hard to study to find out if we boost content knowledge in the early grades. Does it impact reading comprehension? Of course. We published a study here at Fordham a few years ago by our own Adam Tyner and a colleague of his looking at this based on teacher reports of how much time they spend, finding that spending more time on social studies was associated with improvements in reading comprehension. So yeah, this is the case is getting stronger and stronger, which is excellent. Hey, one other thing I noticed, we've been curious about how the pandemic is going to impact all these research studies out there. And here was one where they just kept plowing ahead.
Huh? That's right. And just said, well, you know, the control group is not a pure control group. They got some, you know, they got some treatment too. But hey, I mean, it still worked, right? Because you basically end up with a dosage study because, you know, the other kids got significantly more of of the intervention in the first couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so that's
it's
that's
all good. I mean, at first I didn't like that, you know, I mean, obviously when you're doing an evaluation, you don't want to see that the research developed their own instruments because clearly that could be a little biased. But in this case, you know, we know that these traditional reading tests are sort of crummy. You know, our Robert's been talking about that for a long time. So for them to, you know, try to develop a test that might, you know, pick up on content knowledge and building knowledge, I mean, that's a pretty big task. And so they almost kind of had to do that to be able to demonstrate, you know, what they were trying to teach the kids.
Yeah. All right. Well, very good. Hey, we'll take it. We'll take it. All right. Hey, that is all the time that we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.